Welcome to the History Maps podcast. For this deep dive into the source material, which is a core part of our East Asian history series, we are tracing the intricate philosophical, historical, and social framework of Neo-Confucianism.
Right, and our sources cover a really extensive timeline here.
Yeah, they do. We are tracking this massive system from its origins in the Tang Dynasty through its codification during the Song Dynasty, and then its transmission across Korea, Japan, and Vietnam.
And finally, we will examine its lasting impacts on modern society, you know, today.
Exactly. So if you have ever wondered how an entire hemisphere's approach to education, bureaucracy, and even family structure was shaped by a single philosophical upgrade, this deep dive will provide the blueprint.
It really is the operating system for centuries of history.
It is. And to start us off, I think we need to look at a highly specific moment. The sources describe two scholars sitting in a dense bamboo grove.
Ah, yes. It is the late 15th century.
Right. And these men have dedicated themselves to achieving supreme moral enlightenment. And according to the dominant philosophical system of their time, the universal truth of morality is embedded in absolutely everything.
Including the bamboo shoots right in front of them.
So they sit and they stare at the bamboo. They meditate on it day and night, trying to extract its underlying moral principle.
Which is quite the task.
Yeah, and days pass. They stop eating, they stop sleeping, and eventually one of them collapses from just utter physical exhaustion, coughing up blood.
Entirely defeated by the bamboo.
Right. But the other man, whose name is Wang Yangming, realizes right there in the dirt that the entire intellectual foundation of his empire might be fundamentally flawed.
That moment in the bamboo grove is, I mean, it's one of the most significant pivot points in East Asian intellectual history.
Because he was testing the limits of the system.
Exactly. Wang Yangming was testing the absolute limits of Neo-Confucianism. This was the system of thought that operated as the foundational logic for multiple empires and millions of people.
It dictated basically everything, right?
Yeah, from how a person understood the physical formation of the cosmos to how they structured the government, down to how they interacted with their parents at the dinner table.
But to understand why this massive philosophical shift was even necessary, we have to look at the crisis of confidence that preceded it.
We do. We have to look back at classical Confucianism.
Established by Confucius in the 6th century BCE.
Right, and later expanded by Mencius. It was fundamentally a system of practical ethics.
It gave you the rules for social hierarchy, benevolent governance, and ritual propriety.
It laid out the precise duties of a good ruler, a good father, and a good son. But, and this is the crucial part, it deliberately avoided extensive explanations about the nature of the cosmos, or the afterlife, or the metaphysical structure of reality.
Because Confucius himself avoided discussing spirits or the divine. He focused entirely on human society.
Exactly. And that practical focus worked beautifully for establishing social order.
Until it didn't.
Right. It left a massive intellectual vacuum.
Because following the collapse of the Han Dynasty in 220 CE, there were centuries of severe political fragmentation and instability.
People were suffering, empires were fracturing, and during this prolonged crisis, Buddhism and Taoism rose to immense prominence.
They were offering something classical Confucianism simply did not have.
Yeah, Buddhism provided deep, intricate, metaphysical answers about the nature of emptiness, the cycle of suffering, and personal salvation.
And Taoism provided comprehensive cosmologies based on vital energy, nature, and the alignment of the cosmos.
So you can see the acute anxiety this caused among traditional scholars.
Especially if we look at the early 9th century, during the Tang Dynasty.
Right, with Han Yu.
Yes, a prominent Confucian scholar and official. He witnessed a massive state-sponsored public procession in the capital. And the object of all this veneration was a Buddhist relic.
Specifically, a purported finger bone of the Buddha.
Han Yu watched the crowds, from the emperor down to the illiterate commoners, just caught in a fervor of worship.
But he was not happy about it.
No, he went home and drafted a fiery, historically crucial essay decrying the entire practice.
He argued that Confucianism, the historical bedrock of the Chinese social order, was losing its grip on the culture.
He viewed this foreign religion, with its relics, its focus on the afterlife, and its monastic traditions, as an existential threat to the fabric of society.
And the threat wasn't just theological, you know, it was deeply political and economic.
The sources highlight that the Song Confucian scholars who came later, emerging from the highly fragmented Five Dynasties and Ten Kingdoms period in 960, looked at Buddhist and Taoist practices and saw a direct threat to the state's survival.
Right, consider the core Buddhist concept of monasticism. It requires withdrawing from society.
Leaving your family, taking a vow of celibacy, seeking enlightenment outside the bounds of civic life.
Yeah. Or consider the Taoist concept of wu-wei, which translates to non-action or effortless action.
Which was often interpreted as stepping away from rigid artificial social structures to align with the natural flow of the universe.
Right. And to a Song Confucian scholar whose entire worldview is predicated on active social duty, familial responsibility, and political engagement, these concepts were corrosive.
Because if the brightest minds all become celibate monks or mountain hermits, the tax base collapses.
Exactly. The ancestral rights are abandoned. The state bureaucracy empties out.
Okay. So if we use an analogy here, if classical Confucianism was a highly effective manual for building a house, meaning society,
right,
it told you exactly where the foundational beams should go, who was in charge of the construction crew, and how to maintain the roof to keep the rain out.
Right.
But Buddhism and Taoism were offering explanations for the actual physics of the universe. They were explaining why gravity works and what the wood and stone were made of at a microscopic level.
That is a great way to look at it. The Song scholars realized they could not just keep aggressively pointing at their house-building manual when everyone else was asking fundamental questions about the nature of reality.
So Neo-Confucianism was the process of writing a new, comprehensive physics textbook.
Yeah.
One that proved, on a cosmic, undeniable level, why the house had to be built exactly according to those ancient blueprints.
That perfectly encapsulates the project. To defeat the appeal of Buddhist and Taoist metaphysics, the Neo-Confucians systematically co-opted their depth.
They set out to build that physics textbook by defining the fundamental underlying elements of the universe.
But they had a strict parameter. Whatever cosmological elements they defined had to ultimately validate Confucian social ethics rather than Buddhist withdrawal or Taoist non-action.
So to build that textbook, they had to start at the absolute beginning of the universe. Which brings us to the metaphysical foundations.
Right. We start with Zhu Dunyi, an 11th century scholar.
He wrote a deeply influential, albeit brief, text called the Taijitu Shuo, or the Explanation of the Diagram of the Supreme Ultimate.
And he introduces the concept of Taiji, the Supreme Ultimate.
According to his framework, Taiji emerges from Wuji,
which is the ultimate void, the limitless, or the non-polar.
So from that state of ultimate potential, Taiji generates the entire cosmos through the alternating dynamic movement and stillness of yin and yang.
And that interaction then produces the five phases, wood, fire, earth, metal, and water, which make up all physical phenomena.
Zhao Dunyi achieved something profound here, right?
He really did. He took older cosmological concepts from ancient divination texts, like the Book of Changes, and structured them into a coherent, linear, generative process.
But crucially, he stripped away any need for an anthropomorphic creator deity.
Yes. The universe, in his view, is an ongoing self-generating process of production and reproduction driven by its own internal logic, not by divine fiat.
And following him, we have Zhang Zai, another 11th century thinker.
Zhang focused intensely on the concept of qi, which translates as vital energy, material force, or psychophysical stuff.
He writes a famous essay called The Western Inscription, which radically expands on what qi means for human relationships.
He argues that because all humans, all animals, and all inanimate objects in the universe are generated from and composed of the exact same fluctuating qi, we all exist on a unified ethical continuum.
He famously declares that heaven is our father, earth is our mother, and therefore all people are our brothers and sisters, and all things are our companions.
Which is a staggering ethical leap.
It really is.
He uses a purely material cosmological concept, the idea that everything is made of the same vibrating energy, to justify universal benevolence.
Because if I harm you, I am fundamentally harming a part of the same cosmic body that I belong to.
Exactly. But while Zhu Dunyi provided the supreme ultimate and Zhang Zai provided the vital energy, the system was not fully complete yet.
Right. These discrete concepts culminated in a foundational dualism that would come to define the entire Neo-Confucian movement.
The two indispensable pillars became Li and Qi.
We need to define these terms meticulously because they form the entire basis of the philosophy.
Let's start with Li. Li is the eternal rational principle or pattern that orders the universe. It is the formless, invisible normative structure that dictates not just how things are, but how things should be. It is the absolute moral reason of the cosmos.
And ki?
Ki, as we noted, is the psychophysical energy, the dynamic, vibrating material substance through which Li manifests in the physical world.
So everything in reality, from a mountain to a mosquito to human consciousness, is a combination of Li and Qi.
Yes, the Li is the perfect abstract blueprint and the Qi is the physical building material.
To ensure complete clarity, let's look at this through the lens of modern technology.
Okay, sure.
If we imagine the universe as a vast computer system, Li is the software code. It is the perfect flawless logic that tells the machine exactly what to do.
I like that.
And Qi is the physical hardware. The silicon chips, the wiring, the electricity running through the circuits.
That is a highly functional metaphor. The Li, the software code, is identical across all systems. The code for a perfectly functioning universe is written into everything.
And the Qi is the hardware.
Right. Now, if we apply this to human morality, a critical problem arises.
What's that?
Well, if the lie within every human is perfectly good and rational, if we all have the exact same flawless software, why do humans commit evil acts? Why is there greed, cruelty, and selfishness?
I see. If the software is perfect, the issue has to be the hardware.
Precisely. The Neo-Confucians explain this by arguing that while everyone is endowed with the exact same perfect Li, people are born with different qualities of Qi.
So if your Qi, your physical and emotional hardware, is murky, coarse, or turbulent, the Li cannot run properly.
Right, the signal gets distorted. Imagine trying to run a state-of-the-art operating system on a computer with a cracked motherboard and degraded circuits.
The code is still perfect, but the output is chaotic and broken.
Yes. Therefore, human moral failings are not a flaw in the original design of human nature, which is Li, but a direct result of an impure physical endowment, which is Qi.
But this raises an immediate question about determinism.
How so?
Well, if a person is born with murky hardware, if their Qi is coarse and turbulent from birth, are they just doomed to be a terrible person? Do they have any agency?
Oh, they have absolute agency. And that is the genius of the system. It demands rigorous, continuous action.
Okay, so you can change it.
Yes. If your hardware is murky, you are not doomed. Rather, you have an intense ethical obligation to clean it. You must systematically refine and clarify your Qi so that the perfect lie can shine through without distortion.
And this process of self-cultivation became the central obsession of the Neo-Confucian scholars.
Absolutely.
That imperative to, well, to defrag the hardware, to clean the Qi, leads directly to the monumental methodologies developed by the Chang brothers and the great synthesizer Zhu Xi.
Zhu Xi lived in the 12th century during the Southern Song Dynasty. He is arguably the most influential thinker in Chinese history after Confucius himself.
He sat in his study, painstakingly compiling, editing, and annotating classical texts to create the collected commentaries on the four books.
And in doing so, he effectively defined the standard intellectual and moral curriculum for millions of people across East Asia for the next six centuries.
Because he built heavily upon the work of two 11th century brothers, Cheng Hao and Cheng Yi.
Right. The Cheng brothers established what became known as the School of Principle, or Lixiu.
They boldly asserted that human nature, which they called Ixing, is originally and fundamentally good because it is completely identical to Li.
So Zhu Xi takes this concept that we are fundamentally good but clouded by murky hardware, and he provides the specific instruction manual for how to clean it.
How did he tell people to actually refine their Qi?
He prescribed a method called Guzizi. This translates broadly to the investigation of things to extend knowledge.
The investigation of things.
Right. To overcome the impure Qi that generates selfish human desires, you must exhaustively investigate the principles inherent in the external world.
You know, the phrase investigation of things sounds remarkably like the scientific method.
It does, yeah.
To a modern listener, it sounds like Zhu Xi is telling people to grab a magnifying glass, go out into the field, and study physics, botany, and biology to understand how the world works.
It sounds similar, but the underlying motive was entirely different.
Okay, how so?
Zhu Xi did advocate for the methodical, rigorous study of natural phenomena, historical events, and classical texts. But the goal was not empirical scientific discovery for the sake of technological advancement.
So the goal was strictly moral.
Exactly. The belief was that the moral pattern of the universe, the Li, is holographically present in everything. The Li of a growing plant is fundamentally connected to the Li of a properly functioning government.
Oh, I see.
By carefully observing external things and, crucially, combining that external observation with a strict state of internal reverence or composure, which they call Jing, you gradually accumulate a comprehensive understanding of the universal principle.
So it was a slow, agonizingly accumulative process of moral refinement.
Yes.
And to guide this massive investigative project, Zhu Xi elevated four specific texts.
Four books.
Right. The Great Learning, the Doctrine of the Mean, the Analects, and the Mencius. He prioritized these four books over the older, more complex five classics,
making them the absolute indisputable core of Confucian education. He believed these specific texts held the clearest, most accessible expression of Li.
But looking at the practical reality of this Diwu practice, the sheer exhaustion it implies for the learner is staggering.
Oh, it was immense.
If Li is in absolutely everything, does that mean studying the flow of a river, the growth of a bamboo shoot, and reading thousands of pages of commentary are literally required just to understand your basic moral duty to your parents?
According to the strictest interpretations of Zhu Xi's method, yes.
Seriously?
Yeah, because Li is singular and universal. Grasping the principle of a falling leaf is fundamentally connected to grasping the principle of filial piety.
By investigating the minute details of the world, you are slowly assembling a map of the universal pattern.
You accumulate insight piece by piece, day by day, year by year, until theoretically you achieve a sudden, comprehensive breakthrough of understanding.
But practically speaking, that requires a lifetime of uninterrupted scholarly leisure.
It certainly does.
It requires massive libraries, private tutors, and endless time to sit and accumulate knowledge. Which brings us back to the bamboo grove and the physical collapse of Wang Yangming.
Right, that specific historical anecdote perfectly sets up the massive philosophical backlash against Zhu Xi.
Because not everyone agreed that reading thousands of pages of commentary or staring at plants was the only way to figure out how to be a good person.
No, they did not. And this sparks a profound rebellion within the tradition, which is the rise of Luang idealism, better known as the School of Mind.
The contrast is stark here.
Very. If the Chengzu School of Principle was rationalist, objective, and outward-looking, the Luang School of Mind was idealist, subjective, and inward-looking.
So Wang Yangming's epiphany in 1508 happens after he is exiled to a remote, challenging, malaria-ridden area in Guizhou by a corrupt political faction.
Right. He is stripped of his status, surrounded by hostile forces, and far away from the massive imperial libraries.
He realizes that Zhu Xi's method of investigating external things is literally impossible for him in this environment.
And in the midst of this desperation, he has a profound realization. He deduces that the mind itself is the ultimate source of all principle.
He does not need to look at the bamboo.
No, and he does not need the imperial library. The perfect software code isn't just out there in the world. It is fully, perfectly installed in his own mind.
That realization fundamentally altered the trajectory of Chinese philosophy.
It really did. Wang Yangming built upon the earlier, somewhat marginalized ideas of a 12th century thinker named Lu Xiangshan.
Together, their concepts form the Luang School, or Jingxiu.
They introduced a massive ontological shift. Li is not just reflected in the mind. Li is identical to the mind.
Therefore, investigating external objects is not just secondary. It is a dangerous distraction from the primary task of looking inward.
Yes.
And based on this, Wang Yangming develops his most famous doctrine, Liangzi,
which translates to innate knowledge of the good.
He asserted that absolutely every human being is born knowing right from wrong.
You do not need to read a massive library of commentaries to know that you should immediately save a child who is falling into a well.
That moral imperative is already there, perfectly unclouded, in your innate knowledge.
He believed that the mind, in its original pure state, is the perfect principle.
So the only reason we fail morally is that selfish desires, greed, fear, ambition, cloud our innate knowledge.
Exactly. And he paired this doctrine of innate knowledge with another radical, highly controversial concept.
Which was Zixinghe.
Yes, the absolute unity of knowledge and action.
The unity of knowledge and action completely upends Zhu Xi's accumulative method.
It does. Wang Yangming argued that you do not truly know a moral principle unless you are actively physically applying it in the real world.
So you cannot claim to fully understand filial piety just because you memorized a book about it and passed an exam.
Right. You only truly know filial piety in the exact fleeting moment you are actively serving your parents.
Knowledge and action are not two separate steps. They are a single simultaneous event.
And this wasn't just abstract academic theory for Wang Yangming. He was a high-ranking official and a highly successful military commander.
The sources highlight his career, noting his suppression of violent entrenched rebellions in 1516, 1517, and famously the massive Prince of Ning Rebellion in 1519.
In chaotic, high-stakes, life-or-death military situations, he did not retreat to a tent to exhaustively analyze ancient texts to find the lie of warfare.
No, he relied entirely on his intuitive moral compass, his innate knowledge, to make split-second decisions.
And his success on the battlefield provided immense credibility to his philosophy.
So if we contrast the two schools, Zhu Xi's method in the School of Principle is like trying to map a vast, continent-sized forest by carefully examining the bark, the roots, and the leaves of every single tree.
Which takes a lifetime of painstaking effort, and only the wealthiest scholars have the time to do it. But eventually you get a very detailed map.
While Wang Yang's School of Mind argues that you were born with a perfectly calibrated compass already in your pocket.
You don't need to examine every tree. You just need to clear your mind, trust the compass, and walk in the right direction.
It democratized the pursuit of sagehood. Wang Yangming argued that a street sweeper or an illiterate farmer had the exact same access to moral perfection as the highest imperial scholar, because they both possessed innate knowledge.
Exactly.
Now, regarding how modern historians categorize these philosophical movements, the sources mention a debate over a two-school versus a three-school model.
Yes. For centuries, the narrative was a binary rivalry, the school of principle versus the school of mind.
But modern scholarship introduces a third category.
Right. Following the political shifts in 1949, scholars in mainland China began arguing forcefully for a third distinct branch of Neo-Confucianism called Kiksu, or the school of vital energy.
And this interpretation heavily elevates earlier thinkers like Zhang Zai and later Ming and Qing scholars, who emphasize the dynamic material force of qi over the abstract eternal principle of li.
That's right.
So what is the rationale for introducing a third school hundreds of years after the fact? Is it purely historical clarification, or is there a political angle?
Well, it is intensely debated. Proponents argue that the school of vital energy offers a crucial materialist counterpoint to the rigid rationalism of Zhu Xi and the extreme idealism of Wang Yangming.
It focuses on physical, empirical processes.
However, critics strongly point out that this three-school model is likely a modern retrofitting, heavily influenced by 20th century Marxist dialectical materialism.
I see.
The state had an ideological need to find historical precedents for materialism in traditional Chinese thought.
So many historians outside of mainland China view the thinkers who focused on qi simply as a sub-branch of the broader school of principle.
Because at the end of the day, they all fundamentally shared the same moral cosmology. It serves as a stark reminder of how fluid, subjective, and politically influenced the categorization of philosophy can be.
That makes sense. Now, while the scholars in the academies were fiercely debating whether moral truth came from the mind or the material world, the imperial state had a much more urgent, practical problem.
They needed to manage a massive continent.
They needed a reliable way to select bureaucrats to collect taxes, manage floods, and administer justice.
This is the critical juncture where abstract philosophy transforms into concrete institutional power.
The Mongol-led Yuan dynasty, having conquered China, recognized the desperate need for a systematized bureaucracy to manage their vast new territories and legitimize their rule to the Han Chinese majority.
So in 1313, they officially reinstated the civil service examinations. But crucially, when they did, they mandated Zhu Xi's collected commentaries on the four books as the absolute unquestionable standard curriculum.
And this wasn't just a brief policy experiment. This specific mandate continued unbroken through the Ming Dynasty, starting in 1368, and the Qing Dynasty, lasting all the way until the system was finally abolished in 1905.
For nearly 600 years, if you wanted any measure of political power, wealth, or status in the government, you had to memorize and master Zhu Xi's exact, specific interpretation of the universe.
The Ming Dynasty went even further to ensure ideological conformity by introducing the notorious eight-legged essay format.
The eight-legged essay was a highly rigid, deeply stylized structural format for exam answers. It was designed to test a candidate's absolute logical fidelity to orthodox Neo-Confucian tenets.
You could not just write a persuasive argument or propose a creative solution to a policy problem, right?
No, your essay had to be structured according to eight distinct sections. Things like breaking open the topic, receiving the topic, beginning the discussion, the central legs, and the conclusion.
And each section had rigid constraints on word count, parallel structure, and rhyming schemes.
The psychological toll this took on the educated class is hard to overstate. Students spent decades memorizing texts just to learn how to write these perfectly balanced parallel sentences.
The state
essentially hijacked the intellectual energy of the entire empire and focused it exclusively on passing this one highly specific test.
But, you know, the rationale from the state's perspective was brilliant. It fundamentally transformed state governance. Neo-Confucianism became the ultimate inescapable orthodoxy.
The emperor was positioned not just as a political leader wielding military force, but as the supreme moral agent whose rule was supposed to perfectly mirror the heavenly patterns of Lai.
This allowed the state to rely heavily on ethical indoctrination and cultural consensus rather than just coercive violence.
If you can successfully convince the entire educated class that strict obedience to the state hierarchy is literally written into the fundamental physics of the universe, you have achieved an incredibly resilient society.
Exactly.
But let's look at the concept of meritocracy here, because this system is often praised as being highly egalitarian for its time.
Right. Theoretically, it echoed the ideals of Mencius. Anyone, regardless of their bloodline or aristocratic birth, who studied hard enough to master the four books and pass the exams could gain immense political power.
It was supposed to be a government of the most capable and moral scholars.
That is the enduring mythology of the system. The poor farmer's son who studies by the light of captured fireflies passes the imperial exam and becomes the prime minister.
But the historical reality was vastly more restrictive. The sheer economic realities of the system made it highly exclusionary.
Yeah, the pass rates for the highest level of the exams, the Jinshi or presented scholar degree, were frequently below 1%.
Because preparing for these exams wasn't a matter of casual study. It required years, often decades, of full-time intensive memorization.
A family had to be wealthy enough to excuse a son from agricultural labor, hire private tutors, buy expensive printed books, and pay for travel to the provincial and imperial capitals for testing.
So 90% of society, primarily the peasants, artisans, and laborers, were effectively completely excluded simply due to the exorbitant cost of this education.
It was a meritocracy, but it was a meritocracy strictly contained within the elite landowning classes who could afford to play the game.
That is a vital distinction. It was largely a closed loop. The elite families possessed the resources to produce the scholars who passed the exams to become government officials, who then enacted policies that protected the land and interests of the elite families.
Yet, despite its exclusivity and the immense pressure it placed on students, the system provided a unified, shared, cultural, and ethical vocabulary that bound the vast Chinese empire together across diverse linguistic and geographical regions.
And this powerful tool of statecraft and social engineering was too effective to remain confined to China. It was exported, adopted, and heavily adapted by neighboring powers who recognized its utility for centralizing authority.
Right. Let us trace this regional spread, starting with Korea, specifically the Joseon Dynasty, which lasted from 1392 to 1910.
Neo-Confucianism was initially introduced to Korea centuries earlier, during the Goryeo Dynasty, by scholars like An Yang.
But it truly became the absolute uncompromising state orthodoxy under the brilliant architects of the new Joseon Dynasty, particularly a statesman named Zhang Dojong.
He utilized Neo-Confucian rationalism as a direct weapon to suppress the entrenched power and massive wealth of the Buddhist monastic institutions that had dominated and heavily corrupted the previous Goryeo government.
What is particularly notable about the Korean adaptation is how deeply and rigorously they leaned into the dense metaphysics of the system.
They didn't just adopt it as a superficial political tool. They debated its cosmic mechanics with a ferocity that often surpassed the scholars in China.
The sources detail the famous 4-7 debate, which dominated Korean intellectual life in the 16th century.
This was a sustained, incredibly complex correspondence between two brilliant scholars, Yi Huang, known respectfully as Tu Weigi, and Ji Dasong, known as Kobong.
They debated the exact metaphysical origins of human emotions and morality. The 4-7 debate remains one of the most sophisticated philosophical exchanges in East Asian history.
To understand it, we must define the terms. The four beginnings refer to the seeds of pure moral virtue outlined by Mencius, benevolence, righteousness, propriety, and wisdom.
And the seven emotions are the fundamental human reactions: joy, anger, sorrow, fear, love, hatred, and desire.
The debate centered on where these come from. Do the pure four beginnings emerge exclusively from the perfect Li, while the potentially chaotic seven emotions emerge from the physical Qi?
Tu Weigi argued for a strict, uncompromising separation. He insisted that the pure moral virtues must originate solely from Li, completely untainted by Qi, to preserve the absolute inviolable purity of human morality.
While Kobong, representing a younger generation, pushed back, arguing for a more integrated view. He insisted that you cannot separate the hardware from the software so cleanly when discussing human emotional reality.
And this wasn't merely an academic dispute over terminology. It had profound implications for how they viewed the perfectibility of human nature, and consequently, how rulers should be educated, judged, and counseled.
If emotions are intrinsically tied to murky chi, then a ruler's desires are fundamentally dangerous and must be strictly controlled by scholarly advisors.
Hsiung Korea took this intense moral focus and enforced it heavily throughout society, deeply codifying Neo-Confucian patriarchal hierarchies and rituals into the fundamental Gyeonguk Daejeon legal code in 1485.
So Korea dives into the deepest end of the orthodox metaphysical pool. Then we look at Japan during the Tokugawa period, stretching from 1603 to 1868, and we see a very different application.
Neo-Confucianism gains a serious foothold in Japan via plundered texts and captured Korean scholars during the devastating Bunroku Kichu Wars in the late 1590s.
A Japanese monk named Fujiwara Seika studies these texts, and his brilliant disciple, Hayashi Razan, ends up serving as a key advisor to the early Tokugawa shoguns.
Razan's integration of the philosophy is fascinating because he had to adapt a system designed for a civilian bureaucracy of scholars to fit the needs of a military dictatorship ruled by samurai.
He drafted the Buki Shohado, the strict laws for the military houses, in 1635, infusing them with Neo-Confucian concepts of absolute loyalty and hierarchical duty.
The Japanese adaptation seems far more pragmatic and less obsessed with cosmology than the Korean version.
They stripped away much of the intense debate over Li and Qi and focus heavily on the social hierarchy. It deeply shaped samurai ethics, contributing significantly to the development of Bushido, the way of the warrior.
But they made one crucial modification.
Which was?
In China and Korea, filial piety, absolute devotion to the father and the family, was the highest possible virtue. In Tokugawa Japan, they shifted the priority. Loyalty to the feudal lord, to the shogun, was elevated above loyalty to the family.
That modification was essential for their survival. The Tokugawa shogunate had just emerged from a century of bloody, chaotic civil war.
They desperately needed absolute obedience to the central military authority to prevent the daimyo, the regional lords, from rebelling again.
By elevating loyalty over filial piety, the state ensured that a samurai's ultimate duty was to his lord, not his bloodline.
They eventually enshrined this specific interpretation as official state doctrine in the Kansei Edict of 1790.
Furthermore, scholars like Razan skillfully managed to fuse Zhu Xi's abstract concepts of Li with native Japanese Shinto cosmology.
Yes, equating ancient Shinto deities with the cosmic principles of Neo-Confucianism, creating a powerful, hybridized state ideology.
Finally, if we look at Vietnam, during the Tran and Lai dynasties, we see yet another unique and powerful adaptation.
A highly respected teacher named Chu Van An, living in the 14th century, taught at the Quat Tu Jam, the Imperial Academy in Hanoi.
He actively used the strict Neo-Confucian ethics of righteous moral governance to directly challenge and counter court corruption.
In 1357, he famously submitted a bold petition to the emperor, demanding the immediate execution of 7 highly corrupt, sycophantic officials who were destroying the state.
Submitting a petition like that requires immense physical courage, as the penalty for angering the emperor or his favorites was often death.
Chu Van An's courage was rooted directly in the Neo-Confucian duty of the scholar to rectify the state, even at the cost of his own life.
When his petition was ignored, he resigned his post, demonstrating that his commitment to moral principle was greater than his desire for political power.
Later, the powerful Emperor Le Than Tong, ruling in the late 15th century, fully institutionalized Neo-Confucianism in Vietnam.
He used it to actively supplant Buddhism as the primary state ideology, seeking to build a centralized meritocratic bureaucracy modeled on the Ming Dynasty.
However, he pragmatically blended the rigid Neo-Confucian state rituals with deeply entrenched local Vietnamese traditions of village-level ancestor worship, codifying this syncretic system in the sweeping legal code of 1483.
Analyzing these 3 regional adaptations reveals the incredible versatility of the philosophy.
Korea became arguably more orthodox and metaphysically rigid than even China, deeply invested in the precise mechanics of Li and Qi to structure their society.
Japan utilized the philosophy to enforce a rigid, four-tiered social hierarchy, deliberately emphasizing military loyalty above all to stabilize a newly unified government.
And Vietnam utilized it to legitimize a highly centralized meritocratic bureaucracy while skillfully retaining indigenous religious syncretism to maintain harmony in the villages.
It operated remarkably like a highly flexible operating system. The core code, the fundamental belief in an ordered, rational universe in a strict social hierarchy, was identical.
The different rulers across different cultures could tweak the user interface, adjusting the balance of loyalty versus filial piety or metaphysics versus pragmatism to legitimize their specific regimes and address local political realities.
It is a highly effective system for maintaining control. However, an operating system that is fundamentally designed to enforce strict social order and rigid hierarchy almost always does so at the direct, heavy expense of individual agency and equality.
Which leads us directly to the intense modern scrutiny and criticism the philosophy faces today.
When we look at the historical application of Neo-Confucianism across East Asia, we cannot ignore how it codified and enforced deeply patriarchal structures.
The philosophy's intense emphasis on hierarchical relationships, ruler over subject, father over son, and fundamentally husband over wife, was used to intellectually justify and enforce oppressive practices.
It provided the moral framework for the expansion of foot binding in China, the normalization of concubinage, and severe, often lethal restrictions on widow remarriage.
Women were systematically and ideologically subordinated under the guise of maintaining cosmic harmony and preserving the purity of the familial line.
We must report on these societal impacts comprehensively, as they are a major focus of modern historical scholarship. The sources point out critics forcefully argue that the pervasive Neo-Confucian emphasis on strict hierarchy, unquestioning deference to authority, and the prioritization of collective order over individual rights actively enables authoritarian governance and oppressive social dynamics even today.
We can see this reflected in contemporary metrics. For instance, the World Economic Forum Global Gender Gap Index consistently shows lasting structural impacts in nations historically dominated by Neo-Confucianism, such as Japan and South Korea, particularly regarding political empowerment, corporate leadership, and workplace equality for women.
Critics also frequently point out that the deeply embedded cultural demand for deference to elders and superiors can create highly toxic workplace cultures.
It can enable bullying and stifle innovation because challenging a superior's idea is often culturally coded as a profound moral failure or an act of dangerous disrespect rather than a healthy intellectual debate.
Those critiques are substantial. However, the sources also detail a robust defense of the system's enduring value. Defenders argue that Neo-Confucianism promotes profound virtue ethics and unparalleled respect for education and enduring belief in meritocracy and remarkable social resilience.
Defenders point to the incredible economic rise, rapid modernization, and high literacy rates of East Asian nations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
They argue this success was directly fueled by the deep underlying Neo-Confucian work ethic, its relentless emphasis on communal responsibility over individual gratification, and its immense cultural respect for scholarship and delayed reward.
We see the specific cultural legacy vividly today in the intense high-pressure educational systems of the region. Consider South Korea's vast network of Hagwon cram schools, where students study late into the night, or China's incredibly high-stakes Gaokao University entrance examination.
The fundamental cultural belief that rigorous, exhausting study and self-denial lead directly to moral elevation, social status, and family honor is a direct, unbroken descendant of Zhu Xi's 12th century mandate to investigate things.
The format of the exam has changed from the four books to modern mathematics, but the psychological architecture, enduring suffering for intellectual and social elevation, remains largely identical.
In the 1920s, during the tumultuous early years of the Republic of China, a movement called New Confucianism emerged to grapple with these exact contradictions.
Thinkers like Xiong Shili in his 1932 New Treatise, and later figures like Mo Zongsan, who co-authored a famous manifesto in 1958, attempted to revitalize the philosophy for the modern era.
They wanted to surgically strip away the oppressive, feudal, and patriarchal elements.
They sought to synthesize the core moral insights of Neo-Confucianism, the belief in human perfectibility and cosmic resonance, with Western concepts like Kantian ethics, democratic governance, and modern empirical science.
They argued the philosophy still possessed vital, necessary spiritual answers for a rapidly industrializing modern world.
And we clearly see the vocabulary of the philosophy being utilized in contemporary statecraft. Over the last decade, leaders like Xi Jinping have overseen a substantial revival of Confucian rhetoric in China.
The state utilizes its ancient concepts for national cohesion, framing modern anti-corruption campaigns and social credit systems through the traditional lens of moral governance, self-cultivation, and societal harmony.
This vividly demonstrates that the language and framework of Neo-Confucianism remain a profoundly potent political tool, capable of being adapted to legitimize state power in the 21st century just as effectively as it did in the Ming Dynasty.
It is a framework that continues to shape the world deeply. Think about your own daily life, regardless of where you live. Think about how invisible cultural frameworks completely dictate our concepts of work-life balance, what we fundamentally believe we owe our parents as they age, or our inherent sense of duty to our employers, our communities, or our governments.
Neo-Confucianism isn't just an abstract, dusty theory about qi and li debated by scholars in robes. It was the invisible structural architecture that built the daily realities, laws, and family dynamics of billions of people over centuries.
Studying it forces us to reflect on the unexamined invisible philosophies that are guiding and constraining our own societies today.
It serves as a powerful mirror for our own foundational assumptions about human nature and society, which brings us to a final provocative thought to consider as we conclude our analysis.
We spent a significant amount of time detailing Zhu Xi's mandate for the exhaustive, lifelong study of external things and Wang Yangming's radical counterclaim that all necessary moral knowledge is already perfectly installed inside you.
If Wang Yangming was actually right, and moral knowledge is entirely innate, if we all possess complete Liangzi or innate knowledge of the good, how much of our modern global educational system is built on a fundamentally false premise?
Are we constructing vast, stressful institutions based on the assumption that morality, truth, and capability must be constantly downloaded from external authorities, textbooks, and standardized tests?
Are we spending our entire lives exhaustively investigating external things when the most vital investigation we need to undertake is into ourselves?
Thank you for listening, History Maps. Learn history visually